Good morning, everyone. I don't know if either counsel has participated in a case before with oral argument held in this format, so I'm going to have our marshal show you how we're going to be keeping track of time. And it will appear, do you see, you get a green card with the word start on when it's time to go. Then you will get a yellow card with the 5-minute warning on it, and then when you see the red card, you are to stop. And if you don't happen to see it, I'm apt to remind you that it's time to stop. So are both counsel ready to proceed? You have to be sure when you're ready to proceed. Sarah, I see that your mute button is still on. And though it's good to have it on when somebody else is talking, be sure you take it off when it's your time to speak. So if you are both ready to go, and I know the court is ready and anxious to hear from you, I'll call our first case, State versus Roundtree, and Attorney Lamb, will you please proceed?
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Lamb, and I represent Mr. Roundtree. Under Wisconsin Statute 941-29, every person convicted of a felony, even a felony involving no physical violence, is banned from possessing a firearm for the rest of their life. The ban has no time limit and contains no mechanism by which a person may petition for the return of his constitutional right to keep and bear arms. At issue in this case is whether Wisconsin's firearm ban is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Roundtree, who was convicted over 10 years ago of offense. I ask that this court hold that Wisconsin's firearm ban violates the Second Amendment as applied to Mr. Roundtree. First, this court should find that Wisconsin's firearm ban is subject to an individualized as applied challenge. Heller states that nothing should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons. However, in a footnote, Heller notes, we identify these presumptively lawful measures as examples and warned that there would be time to expand upon historical justifications.
Counsel, are you relying solely on the Second Amendment, or are you relying in part on the Wisconsin provision of the right to bear arms?
We had raised the challenge under both the United States Supreme Court Second Amendment Constitution and then also Wisconsin's Constitution.
Okay, thank you.
And so going back to my point, the court should find that's an individualized challenge because, this would also be consistent with the Seventh Circuit. And by using the term presumptively unlawful, the court had...
Counsel, I want to just follow up on the Chief Justice's question. Most of the evidence, I think, that was presented related to the federal Constitution in terms of the original public meaning of the Second Amendment and how we think through it, and whether this, in fact, categorical ban on felons is of longstanding. The original public meaning of the Wisconsin constitutional provision may or may not be the same. And I wanted to ask if the fact that Wisconsin had a firearms, a felon dispossession law, at the time that amendment was adopted, does that factor into how we consider what the original public meaning of the amendment should be? And again, just focusing on the Wisconsin Constitution piece.
Sure. So focusing on that, we had raised that. We did focus a lot on the Second Amendment just because there has been more explored in that manner. We had raised that as well just because I do feel that the court could provide greater protections under the Wisconsin Constitution. You are absolutely right, Justice, that the statute actually was in place before the Wisconsin had passed their amendment. But I don't think that should necessarily preclude a challenge under the Wisconsin Constitution. I think that if the state wanted to, they could still strike down the statute as unconstitutional as applied. And so moving forward, you know, as I mentioned, I do think we should have an as-applied test. The second point I think this court should really get into and clarify is what test is used to evaluate an as-applied challenge. And so Mr. Roundtree is asking that this court establish a test that says to raise a successful as-applied test, an individual must present facts about himself and his background that distinguish his circumstances from those of persons historically barred. And so I believe that this test, it's also referred to as kind of the dangerous test, or the test for, you know, if you're not a dangerous, if you're, you don't have history of violence, then you do have a Second Amendment right and you should be allowed to possess a firearm. So I would ask that the court adopt.
Counsel, I hear the test, and I heard you say earlier you talked about physical violence. So you're really asking us to overturn Posian because there was no physical violence there. That was a forgery, which I know the court characterized it as somehow violently taking property, but isn't taking property essentially support from your children a more violent type of offense than would be a writing a check against someone you've never seen before, forging a check? I mean, where are you going to draw that line? And are you asking us to overturn Posian? That's my main question.
Yes. So first of all, just to start there, I do think that Posian was wrongly decided for actually a number of reasons. And I can go into that in a moment. But then to your second point of the question, I think that, you know, if the court would decide to leave Posian, I do think that Mr. Roundtree's case is distinguishable because I do think that there's a difference between physically taking somebody's property, intent to take somebody's property, say going into somebody's house to steal something, or you know, writing a check.
Ms. Lamb, let's go with that analogy for a minute. Let's talk about the victims here because I think that's important. In Posian, the conviction was for uttering a forgery, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And in this case, we're talking about somebody who failed to pay child support for his children, correct?
Yes.
So in my mind, and tell me how I'm wrong, both of those are property crimes, correct?
I see, as I was mentioning, I see a difference. I see one intentionally, actively taking property, and I see the other one more as a order violation or physical order where you're taking inaction, you're not doing something.
Or you're retaining property that belongs to your children and to the person who is raising your children. I find that distinction in your brief just really, really rings hollow to me. It is, in my mind, it's a far more aggravated offense.
Yes, and I do think even if this court disagrees with my argument on there, I mean, what this all comes down to is, regardless of how you see the failure to child support, see failure to pay child support, it's a nonviolent offense. And if we go back and you look at the historical underpinnings of this, you know, I think it violates Mr. Roundtree's Second Amendment rights because he's a nonviolent offender. And I don't think that, as I asked, I would ask that this court apply more of a dangerousness test. And I don't think he poses a danger to society. And so for that reason, I do think that this statute is unconstitutional just because it lumps these groups of people together, people who have committed murderies, robberies, burglaries.
The police found the weapon in his house that led to the charge of felon in possession after they executed a search warrant, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Counsel, just want to follow up on your test and sort of maybe how it would practically apply here. So is the inquiry, assuming, let's say we, you know, adopt your analysis, you can raise as-applied challenges. Presumably there's, you know, some measure of heightened analysis or scrutiny that would apply, which would maybe require the state to be put to its proof on this. Is the analysis whether Mr. Roundtree is violent, or is I guess this is my question, it would seem to me that the analysis would be that those who have been convicted of child support, failing to pay child support as the felony here, that people sort of in that narrow subclass are not, do not categorically necessarily pose a danger, right? If that's the question, if the question is dangerousness, is that the inquiry? And would the state then, if so, would the state be required to put on evidence that suggests that people who fail to pay child support pose a danger, as opposed to Mr. Roundtree personally? Because I think the crime in the statute is focused on the underlying crime, not necessarily the individual and while they're dangerous. How do you think through that, and what's your response to that?
So I would agree that that would be one way that the court could focus, is just on the underlying offense, which in this case is child support, and not so much on what happened after that conviction in terms of getting into, you know, what the circumstances of the firearm possession are. And I think the court actually could find support with that line of reasoning with the Third Circuit court cases, where I think they're focusing on what the actual conviction is. And I think that just makes sense in terms of this argument. We're saying the statute's unconstitutional as applied to people who have the child support or Mr. Roundtree. And so I would agree with that. I do think that the court could choose to focus solely on that, and that everything that happens later doesn't necessarily come into the analysis. And so once again, you know, Mr. Roundtree here, I would say this court should establish this test where if you're a violent offender versus the nonviolent, which I think Mr. Roundtree, and I would also note too, we've talked a lot about the child support, but I think it's also interesting that since he has had those child support convictions, it's also been, I think, over a decade, and he hadn't picked up any other additional violent offenses. And so for that reason, I would ask that the court find that the statute is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Roundtree.
Counsel, do we have enough here to make that determination or not? And I'm asking this question because some of the federal circuits that have analyzed these questions, one in particular, they remanded it. And in the question I have here is, did the state get an opportunity to make its case? let's say we agreed with your test or some version of that, that the state would need to prove that those who are convicted the felony of child support are dangerous, assuming that that's the proper analytical framework. Did the state get an opportunity to make its case, or should we decide that, or would the proper remedy be to remand and allow the state an opportunity to make its case on that?
I believe that it's sufficient based on the record. I would also note that in this particular case, there was a post-conviction motion. So every court has had an opportunity as well to weigh in. The circuit court had an opportunity, the Court of Appeals, and then now this court.
So the one complication with that, though, is so the state of the law, as pronounced by the Court of Appeals that we're generally reviewing here, did not really seem to matter what the individual felony crime was. The Court of Appeals had basically seemed to say in a binding way on lower courts, who cares whether you committed the felony of child support or forgery or something else? So the part that I'm maybe a little concerned about is maybe the state didn't get an opportunity because the law didn't allow them an opportunity. They didn't have to win the case. To win the case, all they needed to say was, see, this is a felony. The Court of Appeals said, if you've committed a felony, that's enough. And if we're saying, well, no, not necessarily, as you're advocating here, did they get an opportunity to do it?
I think that's a fair point. And I think that, the court could also rule that way and be justified in that. Once again, though, I mean, we do think that there has been enough and they have had an opportunity. But if not, too, I think that would be reasonable as well to send it back and say, here, consider this case under the test we're applying. Because I think I think that the Court of Appeals, it felt like when you look at their opinions compared to some of these federal cases, I mean, they didn't really talk about anything. They're just very short and conclusory. And so for that, I think the court would be justified in doing that. But once again, I think too, they could, as I said, preference would be that they just say that, under this test, Mr. Roundtree, it's unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Roundtree.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Second Amendment, and the number of articles have been written saying that the right to bear arms goes to a, quote, virtuous citizen, and end quote. And because he's convicted of a felon, he doesn't fit in that category, so therefore disarmament for him because of the conviction doesn't violate a Second Amendment right. Can you speak to that?
Yes. So I would ask that the court not apply that test. And what I look to for support and what I find most persuasive is really if you look at the, I believe it's Judge Hardiman's concurrence in Binderup, and then also the dissent from Judge Barrett in Cantor. And I think that both of those really point out the problems with this virtuous test. Now, first of all, I think it was the Judge Hardiman had pointed out that those that supported this test, a lot of them tended to be of the opinion that the Second Amendment right was the collective right and not an individual right, which is what Heller had in fact rejected. I think that another reason is it seemed more of a philosophical view. It wasn't actually supported with a history and text. And so I won't get into all of that reasoning, but I would direct the court's attention to, like I said, Judge Hardiman's concurrence along with Judge Barrett's dissent, which I really think goes through the historical underpinnings to show that this virtuous test isn't in fact supported by history. Additionally, I would note that if the court were to decide to apply that test, I still think that the statute is unconstitutional as applied. And I think, too, if you look at how some of the federal courts have applied it, first, I would point out that, you know, at common law felonies, they usually only apply to dangerous offenses. So you kind of are going back and looking still at that whole dangerous calculus, which I do not think the child support conviction actually meets that. I would note too that the failure to pay child support, I believe it's the lowest classified felony. Now I'd note originally when it passed, I think it was an E, but at that time that was the lowest and now it's an I. And I'd additionally note, you know, looking at this virtuous test also, Mr. Roundtree, he didn't go to prison on this. And I think that also plays into the test. So, you know, I would ask that the court not apply that test.
Don't you think he didn't go to prison because if he were in prison, it would be difficult for him to pay child support? How can someone, if he's in arrears, thousands of dollars in child support, how is he supposed to pay any, how is he supposed to make money to pay for his children while he's incarcerated?
So, Your Honor, I think that's a good point. I only mention the fact that he didn't go to prison because that's one of the, when they're evaluating the virtuous test, I think that's one of the factors that sometimes comes in. You know, I think that the courts seem to view somebody who's been sent to prison for 5 years as having committed a more serious crime or offense. So that's why I mentioned, you know, the fact that he didn't go to prison because that's just one of the factors that looked at. So,
counsel, can I ask you also on this waiver issue? I know that the Court of Appeals didn't talk about it at all. Are you also asking us, though, to look at class and to then look at the effect of the class case, class versus United States, and to also make a holding that claims the challenge the government's power to criminalize a defendant's admitted conduct survive a guilty plea?
Yes, we are asking that this court find that when there's a challenge raised to the government's ability to criminalize conduct, that that is not something that can be waived by the guilty plea. Now, that being said, I don't, you know, I think it, if the court chooses not to reach that, I think, too, just looking at the guilty plea waiver doctrines, there are reasons that this court should still decide this case. I think that this is a really important statewide issue. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we've had the circuit court an opportunity to weigh in, Court of Appeals, now this court. And so I think a decision on the merits should be necessary. And that also goes back to, too, as I mentioned, I felt that while there are Court of Appeals cases, they didn't really get into some of like the nitty gritty. They're very short and surface level. And so I think it would be important to decide this case just so that we have guidance moving forward how to apply this and when the statute may or may not be unconstitutional. So I would ask the court to find that class stands for, if it's both to conduct, that's not something that can be waived. However, you know, we do acknowledge this court should still decide it, even if that's wrong.
Well, not if it goes to conduct, right? I mean, didn't class make a distinction about whether or not it goes to the government's power to criminalize the conduct? It's not, because the conduct could be whether how the statement was taken or how, right? Those things you waive. You waive challenges to the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. We're just talking about constitutional challenges to the statute, regardless of how they're classified as applied or facial. Is that your position?
Yeah. And I apologize if I misspoke.
That's okay.
Hey, that's what I'm saying. And there are certainly things that I do still think, class doesn't change at all. You know, like a challenge to the admission of evidence. Those, I think it leaves undisturbed. But here in this constitutional context, I think class supports the argument that this court should find waiver does not apply. So thank you for clarifying that for me.
Are you suggesting then that we have to overrule any cases?
I do think that if this court would say that as applied challenges are not waived, I think State versus Cole is an example of that. And so I don't think that would be consistent. So it is possible that some cases might be overruled. But once again, I just would reiterate that there are still a lot of issues and claims that I do believe are waived still. So it wouldn't be a large number.
I want to follow up on the level of scrutiny. You're advocating strict scrutiny, as I understand it, and I further understand the state to have argued that in the Court of Appeals you conceded intermediate scrutiny. Do you want to address that?
Yes. So, first of all, I think that the United States Supreme Court has yet to weigh in on this. So we don't know for sure what the standard is. And I do think in this context, because you're saying a whole group of people, you know, it's not an issue about a specific type of weapon, but you're saying a whole group of people, I do think that there should be a higher level of scrutiny than intermediate. That being said, once again, if the court decides that intermediate is correct, I do still think the statute is unconstitutional. I think there's another option, for example, going back to Judge Hardiman's concurrence, they did not apply any level of scrutiny. And I felt like he justified that based on the fact that Heller doesn't really put any scrutiny out there. So I would ask for something higher.
Counsel, I think this court actually already has resolved that issue. And this is a question I'll pose to the state as well. I was quite surprised to see neither party cite to the Mayo decision. In that decision, we said strict scrutiny is applied to statutes that restrict a fundamental right. And of course, it is settled law with the United States Supreme Court, as well as this court in Wisconsin Carey, that the right to bear arms is a fundamental right. So I think strict scrutiny is the level of scrutiny to be applied in the state of Wisconsin, is it not?
I would agree based on that representation, if that's what that court said, that scrutiny would be appropriate at a higher level. And so for that reason, I would ask, that the court find that the statute is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Roundtree.
Are there any other questions?
I just want to ask one question on class, counsel, and that is, do you think that class binds us, or do you think that class is persuasive in terms of adjusting our language on whether you can raise an as-applied challenge after a guilty plea, after a waiver, or a guilty plea?
So I know the state had pointed out that class can be read perhaps to apply only to federal criminal defendants. I would note, though, that there are points in class where they just refer generally to a criminal defendant. And so for that reason, I'd argue it binds. But once again, you know, I think the court could also find that it's persuasive. So I still would ask, you know, even if the court finds that it's not binding, that they impose a rule that this, that the guilty plea doesn't apply when there's a constitutional challenge such as this. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Attorney Burgundy, are you ready to go? And you have time in rebuttal too, Attorney Lamb, so we'll have you back again. Attorney Burgundy.
Great, thank you. May it please the court, I'm Sarah Burgundy. I'm representing the state of Wisconsin. So what Mr. Roundtree is asking this court to do is pretty radical. He's asking you to go against the reasoning of virtually every federal court that has held that felon dispossession statutes do not violate the Second Amendment as applied to nonviolent felons. He's pushing a strict scrutiny burden with absolutely no support, and he's asking this court to do all of this for essentially nothing.
I'm going to stop you right there, counsel. I just laid out what the support is for strict scrutiny. Can you tell me, did this court get it wrong in Wisconsin Carry and in Mayo?
To be honest, I did not understand Mr. Roundtree to be advancing the strict scrutiny claim under Mayo, but from what every court to have considered the Second Amendment claims, and in particular, these Second Amendment claims involving a nonviolent felon challenging the felon dispossession statute, there's not a single court that has even ventured to say that this should be a strict scrutiny. They've all applied intermediate scrutiny, and the argument has always been whether it's rational basis or intermediate scrutiny.
Do you disagree that the right to bear arms under the Second Amendment is a fundamental right?
I don't disagree that it's a fundamental right, but I disagree that felons retain the right after they've committed a felony. So we get to the, you know, when you're looking at the test under even intermediate scrutiny, you don't get to means end because once a felon's committed a felony, they've lost that right. So
This court eliminated intermediate scrutiny in the Mayo case. And again, and if anyone wants to look at the case, it's paragraph 28. The court said, quote, strict scrutiny is applied to statutes that restrict a fundamental right. So if this statute does affect a fundamental right, which I think is incontrovertible, that the Second Amendment protections protect the fundamental individual right to bear arms, then how could we apply any standard other than strict scrutiny?
Because felon dispossession statutes are facially valid to the extent that they bar nonviolent felons. And that means that felons no longer have a Second Amendment right. So if there's no Second Amendment right, there's no fundamental right that you're applying it to.
Well, everyone in the United States, it is an individual right. It's been recognized as an individual right by the United States Supreme Court. However, the United States Supreme Court, as this court has also done, recognizes that some people may lose their second or forfeit their Second Amendment rights. But it doesn't change the category of it being a fundamental right, right?
It doesn't change the nature of the right, but it changes whether the right's implicated. The right's not implicated.
Counsel, I want to follow up on that. So I want to actually just talk a little bit about some of the evidence regarding the original public meaning of the Second Amendment, if we could for a moment, because it seems that that's where a lot of this debate lies, right? Part of your argument is, well, you know, no, if you're a felon, that's not within the scope of the right protected by the Second Amendment. And therefore you don't apply any heightened level of scrutiny. But I guess I want to push that point a little bit. I mean, the literature out there, particularly since Heller, has really expanded some of the historical research into this. And a number of different courts and cases, like Judge Barrett's decision that was cited, and a number of others, Judge Sykes' opinion in the Seventh Circuit, they go through some of the history here. And it seems to me that the sort of blanket idea that anybody who's a felon has always been able to be dispossessed of firearms doesn't really have much historical support. Certainly some people were dispossessed, and I think that's from what it looks like, it's people who are considered dangerous, a little closer to what your opposing counsel is argued. People dangerous to others, public drunkenness laws, those sorts of things, or maybe potentially treasonous, people who are in danger of rebellion against the United States, for example. There were a number of laws at the time of the founding that have that. But the idea of sort of dispossessing anybody who's committed a crime we denominate a felony didn't really show up in federal law until the 20th century. And so it seems odd to suggest that has a rooting in the Second Amendment. And I wonder if you could address that and maybe provide the best evidence you can that we ought to understand the original public meaning of the Second Amendment as, if we think you're a bad citizen, we can take you right away versus we think you potentially pose a danger to society and others, which isn't necessarily the same question.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to distinguish this idea of violence equaling dangerousness from dangerousness from just being willing to violate the law. And while you're right that there are dissents that cite a number of studies since Heller, which by the way, noted that nothing in its opinion should be taken to cast doubt on the longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons. I'm certain there are historians that can dig into the history of the Second Amendment and say, there were certain crimes that were not heavily punished back then. There's certain crimes that were quite heavily punished back then. There were a number of crimes such as blasphemy in certain places where it was punishable by death, or certain thefts were punishable by death. It was a very wide-ranging form of law and punishment at the time. So I think it's difficult to say, can I go back in time and say, at the time of the founding, did the founders contemplate all felons? Well, felonies looked different back then in a lot of ways. In some ways, they were probably harsher. In some ways, maybe not so quite as harsh. So I think that I think there's a danger in kind of going down this rabbit hole of saying, let's compare apples to oranges to see what exactly was considered, the type of crime that the founders were concerned with in these felon possession laws. Now, I want to be clear, though, that, I think my opponent is kind of equivocating dangerousness with an act of violence, and I think, again, with a whole other group of scholars, it's this idea of the unvirtuous citizen, and that's not necessarily just violence, but it's a willingness to disregard the law. It's this profound disrespect for others. It's committing an act that the legislature has designated a felony, which is, what it's, kind of the brand it's put on this, what it considers one of the worst types of acts you can commit against an ordered society. So it's not just that it's a violent act that you've committed that disarms you. It's this willingness to break the law. It's this demonstration that you think you're above the law that demonstrates your danger to society.
I do think that's really, what you're getting at is part of the question here, because I mean, if you had a law that said anybody who commits a felony cannot donate money to any political candidate, we'd strike that down in a heartbeat, right? So, I mean, the idea that you're talking about a core constitutional right that's violated, it would seem that there'd be no justification, you'd be hard-pressed to find an easy justification for that. So it seems that getting to the core of what is within the right that's covered, that is the question, and that is maybe not an easy answer, but it seems to me that that is, at least in large part, a historical answer if you're trying to determine what is the scope of the right that's protected. Because we do know we have an individual right that at least has some core zone of protections that government can't transgress. And your main argument seems to be this just categorically, if you're a felon, isn't within in that zone. There's a lot of countervailing evidence. You know, I think that's the hard part about your position, that particularly in light of the fact that we have this incredible expansion of the criminal law that was nowhere to be found at the founding. This idea that, there's so many crimes out there. I'm sure we're all felons if we break it down. But it makes it more challenging to say, yes, this is within the scope of the right, as opposed to, again, these rights in the Bill of Rights are there to say, government, you can't go here. And it seems to me that we're going to lean on the side of you can't go here unless you show pretty clearly you can, when our founding documents and the people have said, that's the limit, government, you can't do that.
Right.
Just to springboard off that, Attorney Burgundy, I'm wondering if at the founding that any of the founding fathers of our country contemplating failure to pay child support, it's hard to imagine that they would have either considered it a crime, much less a felony, given the very, very few rights that women had when this country became a country. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, just to springboard off of. I understand what Justice Hagenor's question, but it was a completely different situation, and we as women did not have those rights. No one would have cared.
Right, and I think the focus should be really on the legislature's power and authority to designate the laws it designates as either misdemeanors or felonies or forfeitures or whatever, to make clear that, these are the laws that these are the types of offenses as a society that we are going to say are categorized as the worst. And it is a category. And I know the court and all of us are not entirely comfortable with this idea of entire categories. But again, this is the legislature's power and authority to do within constitutional limits, of course. But, it is up to them on whether what particular crime is a felony, and it's going to include certainly numerous crimes that did not exist at the time of the founding. We have cyber stalking, any vehicular crime, all of these crimes are just, this is in the legislature's power to do.
Counsel, could the legislature decide to strip anyone convicted of a felony for the rest of their lives, could the legislature decide to strip them of every single right that they possess that is recognized under the Bill of Rights?
Well, no. I mean, I...
Then why the Second Amendment, but not another amendment?
Well, we're approaching this question as applied. So it's been established that the felon dispossession statutes are facially valid to the extent that they bar nonviolent felons. And again, there's a whole analysis for it. So if there's another right that the legislature decides we're going to bar felons for the rest of their lives, it would be an analysis under that particular amendment and that particular right. If they just said it's all of them, I think that would be a problem. It would be a long case for sure, but I think it depends on the right.
Counsel, please, I'm just finished.
I was going to say the same thing. So,
I want to return to the level of scrutiny. This exciting exercise in Mayo, which was an equal protection case, as I recall, dealing with the constitutionality of the caps, I like this word, eschewed, or maybe we chewed up, test that was set forth in Furden. And the test set forth in Furden was referred to as a rational basis with teeth, something between rational basis and strict scrutiny. And in Furden, we described what that test was. And I think it is paragraph 78. The inquiry is whether the legislation has more than a speculative tendency, whether it has more than a speculative tendency as the means for furthering a valid legislative purpose. So that's what we said this in-between sort of thing was that Mayo was getting rid of, that Furtin rational basis with teeth. But as set forth in State versus Pocan, the Court of Appeals case in 2012, and other opinions, there's a different test for what's referred to as intermediate scrutiny, as I saw it anyway. That asks whether a test is, quote, substantially related to an important governmental objective. And that's in paragraph 11 in the State versus Pocan. To me, that seems like it's a different test that Mayo did not address. Are you prepared to address that distinction here today?
I am not prepared to address that. I'm afraid I did not review Mayo before in prepping for this case, and I didn't understand, I didn't understand how it could be advancing the strict scrutiny argument under that case.
Okay. Fair enough. But that's why I ended my question. Are you prepared to do it? I mean, you've appeared before the court before, and you're always prepared, but you just didn't see that as a as an argument being advanced here, as I understand it. Okay.
Yes, and thank you, Your Honor. That was kind to say. I do want to point out in the Cantor decision when that court's talking about the when they're talking about the intermediate scrutiny standard that they're applying, and this is, again, kind of the standard that federal courts have been applying in interpreting the Second Amendment for, you know, for a while, they make a comment that it's almost, when you brought up the rational basis with teeth distinction, I was kind of thinking of this, that this is more intermediate scrutiny light, I guess, going the other way, that so basically the court's saying, this is in note 10 in Cantor, our means end review is arguably less rigorous in this case because the weight of the historical evidence summarized above suggests that felon dispossession laws do not restrict the core right of the armed offense, but rather burden activity lying close to the margins of the right. So in that case, the state can prevail with less evidence when guns are forbidden for a class of persons who present a higher than average risk of misusing a gun.
Let's explore that, counsel. I still think strict scrutiny applies, and I'll have to be persuaded that it doesn't, since we're dealing with a fundamental right. But let's say intermediate, light, or whatever you want to call it, applies. I'm going to refer you to State v. Thomas, the concurring opinion by Judge Shipson. In that opinion, he said, one man beats his wife, harming her physically and emotionally and traumatizing their children. He may only have committed battery, a misdemeanor. Another man enters a garage to steal a shovel. He has committed burglary, punishable by years in prison, a felony. So Wisconsin law allows the man who beats his wife to possess a firearm, but the man who steals a shovel cannot possess a firearm. How could a law like that survive any level of scrutiny?
Well, because again, it's facially constitutional to ban nonviolent felons. And if the legislature describes one crime as a felony and not another, it can do that. Now, this legislature could also bar violent misdemeanors or create a category of misdemeanors that it wants to dispossess itself of firearms. It can do that. Again, it would be subject to probably challenges, but that's against it. It's not based on the level of violence. It's based on what the legislature has said. This is what we consider to be the danger in committing these sorts of crimes. And it committed, in that case, it considered burglary that didn't necessarily involve violence higher than the battery. Now, perhaps that was a mistake by the legislature. But again, I think it goes back to the point, if Mr. Roundtree wants relief, he needs to either ask for a pardon or go to the legislature to change the law.
Counsel, I think the so one of the arguments you seem to make in your brief was that because we've found, or because it's been generally accepted that these are not facially unconstitutional, that that has some relevance to this question. But that's not normally how our facial jurisprudence works. All you need is one example where it's okay to do it, right? And that then they can do it. So the Court of Appeals opinions here, which, you know, obviously we've never passed on this question, so we can look at this afresh here. But the Court of Appeals opinions seem to sort of basically not allow any kind of as-applied challenge, you know, looking at it. They seem, the argument, you know, in those opinions is very perfunctory. And what bothered me a little bit as well is that they don't actually put the state to its proof. Normally, if you have any kind of elevated scrutiny, which the Court of Appeals does, that would be the obligation of the state in that situation. You know, for example, you know, discrimination against women in federal laws typically held to involve some level of kind of heightened intermediate scrutiny in the VMI case. But in that situation, again, whenever you're past rational basis, the burden shifts to the other side. So how are we supposed to deal with that fact in the Court of Appeals the Court of Appeals framework not allowing you to make your case?
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because and one thing that became apparent when researching this is that the burden of proof in these cases is a little up in the air at best. So to clarify, the Court of Appeals did is said, well, okay, we have this law, it's facially constitutional to bar nonviolent felons. And if the reasoning is that the legislature can deem this group of people unvirtuous, or it's this unvirtuous citizenry theory that encapsulates it. So if it's up to the legislature to make these laws and declare he's a felon, they fit into this unvirtuous citizen idea. Once they do that, we can look at the language in Heller demonstrating that we're not, you know, that these you know, heightened tests don't apply really to felons. Nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on it. It's presumptively lawful for a defendant to come in and say, well, my felony was nonviolent. That's not going to get anywhere. Now, I think when you, you look at the Cantor decision, the court did really go to town on kind of the full analysis. Let's look at everything, all these parts. But it really still didn't go into very deeply the facts of the crime, this sort of as applied notion. And I think you can kind of get an idea where the court started heading after they sort of make their main decision in these cases. Because immediately after Heller, there was another case in the Seventh Circuit, Hatfield. In that case, basically three pages. Of the court saying, you know, Cantor controls. We've already said that nonviolent felons, aren't. This is fine as applied. It was fine as applied in Cantor. It's fine as applied here. The courts can engage in the shorthand, and I think part of the concern a lot of these courts are expressing is, this is a really kind of a wild analysis for courts to undertake. I don't know exactly what factors are supposed to come through, what factors are the court supposed to consider. One thing that Mr. Roundtree's putting forth is that my felony is 10 years old. So because time's moving, what happens if this court says no to Roundtree now, can he file another case in 2 years and say, well, two more years have passed. It's going to create an amorphous standard, yeah. First of all.
But it would seem to me, counsel, that the analysis would be, because the way the criminal statute is written, you are not allowed to possess a firearm statute has nothing to do with the individual's actions. It has entirely to do with a category of crime. So it seems that it has nothing to do with Mr. Roundtree in particular, that the proof that you would be put under if your opposing counsel is correct is to satisfy whatever level of analysis we'd apply, some form of heightened scrutiny, that those who are convicted of child support, that law is justified, or in depending on what the category would be, right? If it's dangerous, if that's the category, if we accepted that argument, then you'd have to prove that those who do that are a danger to society in some way. So our task is to sort of figure out what the core of the protected right is under the Constitution, you know, and the rest of it would seem to flow from there.
And I guess I would submit that it's actually, once we've established that the legislature can ban nonviolent felons and in the category in a law that's otherwise rational law that is a felony, it's the defendant's burden to prove that he's outside of that category. And I think that's what the Seventh Circuit in Hatfield talked about. And that's, what I understood from counsel's opening statement that, you know, on an as-applied challenge, he should have an opportunity to show that he's outside the category. So I think the burden is a little fiddly on these cases because, once we say the legislature can ban nonviolent felons, I think it's up to the defendant at that point to prove that they're outside of that category.
That's not normally how we deal with constitutional rights. Even if you accept that the federal government, for example, or the state government has a right to regulate campaign finance law, if somebody sues and says this particular regulation is a violation of my constitutional rights, even accepting you could do something here, we would apply a heightened level of scrutiny to that person because they're claiming that there is a restriction on this area, again, where the people have said through their constitution, you can't go there. You can't regulate this. Right.
Yeah, and I think this is just an odd situation where, I can't think of an equivalent situation where the legislature, you have a facially valid statute that categorizes a group of people like this, that wouldn't be like an equal protection challenge or something that goes there where that you're saying it would cover the as applied. And I think that was kind of my, one of the, something I thought a lot about in briefing this case, and I want to make clear, I'm not saying that, create a rule that like once something's facially constitutional, you can't have an as-applied. Of course not. You as-applied challenges are very important. But I think in just reading all the law and all the decisions and every single court that's considered this, they've really just keep reaching this point. There's just no... This is just really the point it gets to.
Counsel, can you briefly address, I read in your brief at the end you talked about class case and the waiver rule in Wisconsin, and you're seeming to rest on the fact that it was a federal criminal defendant in class, and therefore what the United States Supreme Court is saying about what kind of challenge class was making doesn't apply to Wisconsin's waiver rule. And I'm not finding that. I mean, is there anything else in class that you believe would argue that this does not apply to Wisconsin? I mean, the mere fact that the facts are such that it's a federal guilty plea, that doesn't seem to be very persuasive to me.
Well, Your Honor, I think when the court the court's talking about a federal defendant and the application of Rule 11, which is a federal rule, their federal rule of pleas and waiver, and it's different from ours. First of all, it's a rule that only Article 3 courts apply. So I am not sure that class certainly doesn't mandate. I don't think state courts to do anything. I think class is speaking to federal courts, first of all.
Have any other state courts held that? Are you aware that it doesn't mandate?
I'm not aware. I really couldn't find very many courts talking about class at all. And even the federal courts that have talked about it really haven't thought it did anything. The other thing is that traditionally, so, you know, what class did really was just reaffirm the Men of Blackledge doctrine. That's consistent with how we've understood the guilty plea waiver rule to work in terms of the facial and as applied divide, and a majority of federal courts have also understood that. And in the wake of class, I haven't seen any federal courts that kind of apply that as applied facial distinction, say, well, okay, class said that's no good, and class doesn't even it doesn't really even talk about the as applied facial distinction. So I think at best, class maybe throws up a question mark that perhaps worst case, maybe down the road, if there's a little bit more development of it and a little more clarity. I mean, I think it's also just a kind of unclear decision. So I don't think there's really much to it that should compel this court to reevaluate its federal, the guilty plea waiver rule at this point at least. I wanted to address a few points that came up.
I think your time is up.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
If you were just going to finish a thought, I would let you do that. But if you're going to address new topics, I think that we need to move to rebuttal.
Fair enough. Okay. Thank you, Your
Very
Honor.
Very good. Yes. Okay. Attorney Lamb, are you ready to go?
Yes. Thank you. So I just wanted to make one point. There was, the state had mentioned the lack of challenges regarding that have prevailed. And I just wanted to note, in if you take a look at what other state statutes are, a couple of points. One, there are some state statutes that do divide or treat nonviolent offenders different than violent offenders. And so that could explain the lack of challenges. And then second, if you look at the child support felony in particular, I mean, in other states, it can be a misdemeanor. So not every single state has this as a felony. And so for that reason, I mean, that may explain partially why this case is a little bit unique in this context, just because Wisconsin's statute is such a broad, it's a permanent lifetime ban. And so for that reason, you know, Mr. Rountree would ask that this court find that the statute is unconstitutional as applied.
There's a misdemeanor failure to pay support charge, though, correct?
Yes, and I'm actually glad you mentioned that, because the way, too, I mean, and that to me highlights how arbitrary this can be. The way we do it in Wisconsin, my understanding of the statute is if it's less than 120 days, it's a misdemeanor. But if it's greater than 120 days, it's a felony. And so to me, that really opens up the door to be able to kind of, a lot of this is going to depend on how a prosecutor charges this. So, you know, maybe in this case, they did the 120 days. So he got the felony. And that to me is just a little bit unfair and arbitrary based on how you count the days. Like I said, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, somebody who maybe didn't pay for 119 days, he gets to possess firearms. But then somebody who didn't pay for 121 days, that person doesn't get the right to possess firearms. And so I think that's really the harm in allowing the focus just to be on what the legislature says is a felony and what the legislature says is not a felony.
Counsel, please.
Oh. Please.
I don't find that compelling. So push back and persuade me. You respond by saying, well, it seems a little arbitrary depending on how they're going to charge it. Well, we see that all the time. A battery charge amended to disorderly conduct, where the max is, what, 90 days or something. So the idea that it is subject to prosecutorial discretion just seems to be inherent in the system that Wisconsin and other states have rested on, and that is the plea bargaining system. So tell me why I'm wrong and you're right.
So just to clarify the point, what the problem I see, or the point I'm trying to make, is that it's not enough just simply to say this person loses their rights because they're a felon. And that's why I think we need to go back and look at the historical scope and the text to say who doesn't or does have a right under the Second Amendment to bear arms, just because, once again, I mean, we shouldn't be understanding the context of this constitutional right based on how the legislature is choosing to classify something, because there can be a lot of distinctions. And I think the other Justice Bradley had brought up the point, I mean, with the Thomas case, where they point out the fact that somebody who has a misdemeanor battery conviction has been abusive to their wife, we're allowing them to possess a firearm in Wisconsin under our statute, at least. Whereas somebody, you know, like Mr. Roundtree, who has a non-violent prior conviction for failure to pay child support convictions, is not allowed to. And so that's why I think it's important just to look at the history and the context of the right.
And in looking at that, do you know the year that the child support statute was passed, the failure to pay child support statute?
Yes, I believe it was in, I'd like to say 1985.
I think that's correct.
And I think just in general, my understanding is the failure to pay child support laws really kind of came into existence in the mid to late 1900s. And so it wasn't necessarily in existence at the time.
When was Wisconsin's felon dispossession law passed?
I apologize, you cut out.
I'm sorry, do you know when Wisconsin's felon dispossession law was passed?
I believe it was 1981. Thank you. Does anyone else have any more questions?
Well, looks like you have answered them well, and thank you both for a very good oral argument. Thank you for participating in this new format. We are concluding now as we all get ready for our second case of the morning. So thank you so much.